the spacecraft that's telecommunications that's going to be going to the geosynchronous point. So I think that's the first for SpaceX doubling for Falcon 9, putting a spacecraft at the geosynchronous point. So that should be pretty good. And then the big attraction for NASA this year anyway will be the launch of the Maven spacecraft. That's going to Mars, and that will be on the 18th of November. So that's the Mars atmosphere and volatile evolution spacecraft. So that's an orbital mission and a polar orbit of Mars. Probably about a 2-year mission. They'll probably get an extension on it. So I just wanted to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Paul, send it back to us for any questions. Anybody got any further questions for the space section? Give us your call letters and name right now. K2LIW. Okay, there being none. Is there somebody? Okay, maybe not. I know that Wes did have a further subject he wanted to discuss, and this time we're not super short on time. So we got some time to discuss your material, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, N2XJN. I have sent to Bernie Connelly that kind of material of two video clips from YouTube, all of them related to atomic force microscopy. So if with high level of microscopy we're dealing with scanning electron microscopy, transmission electron microscopy, and atomic force microscopy. What is kind of clever in atomic force microscopy is a mechanical device. And I remember the doubt that Dick had about seeing rows of atoms from electron microscope, where the resolution of the electron microscope, scanning electron microscope, is more than 1 nanometer. And now we are approaching the subject of mechanical microscope that is able to actually bump on a virus or a particle, and the size of the particle could be as low as 0.1 of nanometer. For those who do not know how much is a nanometer, well, actually 0.1 nanometer is 1 angstrom. And the typical atomic diameter is 0.3 of nanometer. So that the mechanical device called microscope is 1/3 of the size of an atom in the diameter of the tip of the cantilever. Some information at the beginning of. A nanometer is a unit of measure, just like inches or feet. And nanometer is 1/1,000,000,000 of the meter. Meter is 39 inches long. And 1,000,000,000 times bigger than 1,000,000,000 as number or you write. So the nanometer size is a pretty nice small one that will allow to see the atomic structure and the single atom in a row, but not inside an atom. The atomic force microscopes are pretty much compatible to the scanning electron microscopes or transmission microscopes. The example, what a molecule is less than 1 nanometer. The germ is about 1,000 nanometers. The human hair is about 100 thousandths of nanometers. And the molecules that are released from the cookies when it bakes are less than 1 nanometer in size, and so they are being carried out through the air for our noses because they are so small. Surprisingly, gravity doesn't have much to do with it because the mass of the molecule is very low. So how the atomic force microscope works? The principles of it is that you have a bending cantilever spring, and it responds to the external forces. In the case of adhesive interaction between the tip and the surface, the forces are about 0.1 to 1 of nanonewton. These measure forces are small as, I don't even know how to say it, but in order to detect the bending of the cantilever, when the cantilever goes, say, on the fibers of the molecule, what they do is, at first they use the solution for the fibers, and when the virus goes to the bottom of the compartment, it gets stuck. So the cantilever moves over the virus, and it goes up a little bit, and then actually you can squeeze the virus. When you squeeze it too much, it breaks. And you have a laser diode and a point position sensitive photodetector that would be sort of quadruple detector, where then the reflected laser beam from the tip of the cantilever spring will go through the cross section of the four photodiode detectors and would actually measure that you are on the top of the virus. A pretty much nice device. So coming back to the microscopes. The resolution of the electron microscope that I'm in the possession of is guaranteed for 20 nanometers, but it goes down to 10 nanometers. And in 10 nanometers, if we know that the size of the of an atom is 0.3 of a nanometer, and the mechanical device goes to as low as to 0.1 of nanometer, actually we could see the row of the atoms. We could count how many atoms do we have. Back to you, Dick, and to you.
Quick question, Dick.
Yeah, I've got some comments on this, but go right ahead first, John, go ahead.
I believe Wesley said the atomic structure is 3 nanometers, and the probe on the cantilever is 1, or maybe they were tenths. How do you make a probe smaller than the atom itself? Back to you, Dick.
It's 0.3 nanometers, the size of an atom. The atomic, I'm reading right now, an atomic force microscope can reach a lateral resolution of 0.1 to 10 nanometers. A typical one works from 0.1, from 10 to 50 nanometers. That's the standard AFM that contains microscopic tip curvature radius. How do they do it? With the nano milling machine. And that nano milling machine could be done in the vacuum chamber that I have. And to exit.
Are you saying the probe is smaller than the atomic structure?
That is the tip of it. The tip of it is small. Then
how could that be, Dick?
Gotta understand which atom we take into consideration, because the sizes of an atom varies. And here we go. The size of an atom can be estimated in the use of Avogadro number.
Let me put a couple of words on this.
And that will understand about the bulk density of the solid material. And that would be for the volume per atom that is determined. So actually we're taking the atomic volume, then we take the molar mass in grams and divide it by density in gram per square. So in other words, when they reach the tip that is smaller than an atom, we're talking about atom of as a target being of different material than atom that tip is made from. But that's the theory. In the reality, it works quite opposite way. Actually, that middle part on numbers of atoms and is not that thin, but because you have that very much delicate structure, another method is being implemented, and that is a kind of samples that are being called the tapping mode in general. What it does is it is a simulated vibration near the resonant frequency of about 300 kilohertz, and on the approach to the surface of vibration, amplitude of the cantilever will decrease, but any differences to the smoothness of it will then be measured by a measurement of the constant deflection to the surface that is scanned. I would like to recall our conversation from a few weeks ago when I was standing about the American scientists sleeping an atom in destruction using a mechanical device. They were using exactly the same. They were vibrating the needle, sort of like you put a needle inside the solution, and you're actually stirring in it. So if we say that the structure is not homogeneous, they were able to flip two different atoms. And that's what they state for is the beginning of new memory for the computers. And to achieve.
Yeah, I've got a way of looking at this whole thing, and let me go step by step. One of the smallest atoms we know of is a helium atom. And the helium atom is in the vicinity of 1 angstrom in diameter, 10 to the minus 10 meter. Well, a nanometer is 10 to the minus 9. So a tenth of a nanometer is approximately the diameter of a helium atom. Many other atoms are around 3 times that diameter. So 3 angstroms, or 3 tenths of a nanometer, is possibly a typical size of an atom that's on the surface that you and I care about. And at first you'd say, okay, I'm going to aim my microscope at this, I'm going to turn the gain up real high, and I'm going to view it optically. I'm going to show you why you can't do that, and then I'm going to show you what the alternatives are. Let me drop. I'd like to use my optical microscope, shine a nice white light on the surface. I'd like to use real high gain. I'd like to start seeing the atoms on the surface. Okay. The optical wavelength your eye operates at, the center of that band, is 550 nanometers. The object you want to look at is 0.3 nanometer. So you're wrong by around 1,500 to 1. In other words, the object you want to look at is 1,500 times smaller in diameter than the wavelength of light that your eye operates at. Overly obvious, your eye is not going to do it. An electron microscope or X-ray type machines, you can go to some smaller wavelengths, but can you make up a 1,500 to 1 ratio? Not likely. And by the way, you don't want to just be able to get the wavelength to be equal to the atom you're looking at. You'd like to have the wavelength considerably smaller so you can see the details and the bumps, so to speak, and you can't do it. Let me drop. So instead of looking at an optical with light, you do a mechanical equivalent. You make yourself an extremely sharp needle, and now, by way of a very precise positioning machine, you bring that needle extremely close to the surface, like a an angstrom away, so to speak, and now you've got multiple ways by which you can mechanically scan across the surface and detect the position of the local atoms of that very smooth surface. One of them is electron tunneling. In other words, you carefully adjust a small amount of voltage between your probe and the surface, and you carefully adjust the distance so that you get a certain number of electrons to jump from your needle over to the surface. They're called tunneling electrons. So you carefully wave your needle up and down as you scan it in X and Y in order to get a constant number of tunneling electrons. You're measuring the current. That's one approach. The other approach is to take this cantilever thing where you're waving this cantilever at, say, 300 kilohertz or some frequency like that is the frequency at which you're waving it. And the end of the cantilever has a very sharp mechanical point. The mechanical point with this very minor amount of waving is brought close to the surface. Let me show you what's happening here. You don't touch the material. Let me drop. You, for instance, push your hand against the table right now. Push your hand against the wall. You think your hand is touching the wall. Absolutely not. If you had high enough magnification, you would see that the wall has a whole lot of molecules. Those molecules have got, every one of those molecules has a cloud of electrons around each nucleus. The molecules of your hand have a cloud of electrons around each nucleus. When you try to push your hand against the wall, the molecules of your hand come extremely close to the molecules of the wall, and when those electron cloud of the wall molecules sees the electron cloud of your hand molecules, the electrostatic repulsion at the microscopic level is an extremely big number. Your hand never touches the wall. It comes extremely close. It doesn't touch. All the air molecules in that room that are waving against, that are moving at 500 meters per second, and you think you're touching the glass, you think you're touching the side of the bottle that contains the air molecules. All of those air molecules never touch the surface. They come extremely close. The electrostatic repulsion of the cloud of electrons of the air molecule and the cloud of electrons of the bottle or the glass or whatever, they repel each other, and it's a perfect repulsion. No energy is lost in that repulsion of those moving air molecules. So, let me drop. You take this cantilever that's waving at, let me pick a number that Wesley used. I don't know the exact number. Let's assume it's 300 kilohertz or 3 megahertz. You're waving your tiny little cantilever with a sharp point on the end of it. The sharp point comes close to the local molecule of the surface that you're scanning over. The tip of your sharp point comes close to the tip of the molecule of the surface that you're scanning. The electrostatic repulsion constitutes another spring. Therefore, the natural resonant frequency of your cantilever senses the other spring, and the cantilever frequency increases. So as you come close, and don't touch, but as you come close at a 300 kilohertz rate, the rate of the natural resonant frequency of your cantilever goes up, and now you keep a record of the cantilever frequency as you wave it across the surface. You properly plot that, and you're now plotting the bumps and valleys of the surface. The tip itself of your sharp point on the end of the cantilever, let me drop, might be a little bit larger in diameter than the molecules you're looking at on the surface. Might be a little larger in diameter. Still, as you wave it over the surface, you will still sense the pumps, the peaks and the valleys, if you know what I mean. As you're plotting the cantilever natural resonant frequency, as you're waving across that surface, you will sense the location of those fixed position molecules that are on that surface. So by this mechanical scanning process, you're developing a kind of a picture of the surface. And so if some of those molecules on the surface were damaged by some process so that there was a slip plane, as they say, and there was a flaw in the molecules and the way they were assembled, maybe because there was a dopant that was put in there, some foreign material or whatever, with this mechanical scanning process, the atomic force microscope, or your scanning electron microscope, your tunneling microscope. There's various kinds of mechanical procedures by which you can sense the peaks and valleys of that surface. You can't do it with a photograph. You can't do it with light, because the wavelength of the light is 1,500 times too big. It's really 15,000 times too big for what you would like to have in order to have good resolution of what you're looking at. Now, with this process, let me drop. With this process, you're scanning and sensing the surface of those molecules, the outer shell of electrons and those electrons and those locations. You're sensing that. By this procedure, you're never going to see what's inside of that molecule. You're never going to see the second, third, and fourth shell of electrons that are down below, or the nucleus. You're not going to see that. You can't do it that way. But at least you can sense the outer surface of those molecules. That's my guess as to what's going on. Let me first turn it over to you, John, to see if you've got a somewhat similar impression, and then you turn it over to Wesley. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
That's wrong. KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, well, I look at it. A molecule is a combination of elements. Element is an atom. Now, he's talking about an atomic structure, not a molecule. And I don't understand. The point of that needle is so much larger by a significant number than the atomic structure. I can't fathom how that can work. I know it is working. I saw the videos. I watched that. But, I can understand it with a virus. Okay, but that's so much larger than an atomic structure. So, it's interesting what you said, but I'm not following it completely. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, somebody, let me drop. I'm giving you my speculation. Somebody said that's wrong. Hopefully that person is closer to this, knows more about it. The person who said that's wrong. I'd like to hear you. Tell me your call letters, your name, and after that you're going to tell us what the correct information is. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick. The person who said that's wrong, quite possibly you are right. Please tell us who you are, because I'm going to ask you for the further information. Who was that person? Okay, the person doesn't have the nerve to tell us what he knows. But by mechanical scanning procedures, you can sense the surface. The fact that the tip of your sharp needle is slightly larger in diameter than the molecules you're scanning over, that lowers the resolution. You'll still sense that there are peaks and valleys. You're not going to sense very much of the valley, if you know what I mean. So, as long as you're sensing the mechanical force of things coming close together, it's actually electrostatic repulsion, or whether you're sensing the tunneling electrons between the two, and you're carefully adjusting the surface distance until you keep that number of tunneling electrons constant as you scan, by either of those mechanical scanning procedures, you stand a chance of figuring out what the surface looks like, even though you don't stand a chance of seeing it optically. And so I know you're troubled by the fact that the tip of the needle might have a molecule that is larger than the molecules you're looking at. Well, if I chose a material that has very small molecules, maybe it's lithium. I'm not sure what they make the tip out of. But if I choose a material that has very small molecules, but it is a solid material, probably metallic, and then if I'm looking at relatively large molecules on the surface that I'm scanning over, I think I stand a chance of keeping the atomic force constant by way of the cantilever frequency, or keeping the number of tunneling electrons constant as I scan across. I think I stand a chance of finding out where the bumps are in the surface, which constitutes the outer cloud of electrons of the individual molecules of the surface.
Repeater, time out.
So that's my speculation as to what's going on. Does it still sound impossible to you, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a couple of comments.
It doesn't sound impossible, Glenn recognized. It doesn't sound impossible, but now we're talking about the detection of field strength. We're not really touching the electron. We're squashing that atom. So detecting the field? Yeah, I believe that. Let's see what Glenn has to say.
Well, you're not squashing that atom. You're coming close to it. The electrostatic repulsion of the atoms of your needle and the electrostatic repulsion of the outer electrons of your atom of your needle and the electrostatic repulsion of the outer shell of electrons of the molecule of the surface, you're coming close. You never touch, you never crush them. You just sense the force when they come close to each other, the force of electrostatic repulsion of negative and negative. That's the way I see it. Let's see what Glenn sees. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet. Make sure you wait for the beeps.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I guess I've been trying to follow this, but I've been listening with half an ear, but I guess something had come up where it just something didn't sound right to me. And the first one was that possibly trying to view with an electron microscope subatomic particles, is that the discussion?
Dick, Jan.
No, we're talking about...
About atomic force microscope, but I was giving a comparison to the scanning electron microscope resolution or the transmission microscope resolution. Now, Dick, you can open up the email that I just sent you, and I've got a confirmation from Bernie's family that he put it posted. That one, you don't have to open any link, you just read it. It states that the laser is able to detect as small bending as 0.100 nanometer. The resolution of that mechanical device is 0.1 of nanometer, the lowest one. The size of an atom on that particular email, you don't have to open anything. Typical atom is 0.3 of nanometer, and by that, and also it says that a typical normal AFM, which is the atomic force microscope, is 10 to 15 nanometers of the cantilever spring. You just read it and then you have it in front of your eyes. So if I say that at the resolution of 1 to 10 nanometers, you are possibly able to count an atom, it must be true. Because I've got it from a number of sources.
Yeah, Dick, I think Wesley answered the one part of the question for me, but I guess the next question is for Wesley is, how small an item do you think you can see inside an electron microscope?
It depends on the resolution. The one that I have supposed to be 20 nanometers goes down to 10 nanometers, but they have electron microscopes that are lower than 1 nanometer. Now, again, I stress, 1 angstrom is 0.1 of nanometer. And the articles that I have mentioned state that the mechanical device that I'm talking about, which is atomic force microscope, the wording exactly is sub-nanometer scale. So, here we are. You just open up and then you read it and then you argue with the articles, and I have hundreds of them. And there's Jean.
Glenn, what do you think is the smallest resolution of a scanning electron microscope? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Well, resolution, I think, is a very, very deceiving word in this conversation. I think what we're trying to figure out here is how small an object can you really see inside an electron microscope. Now, I mean, I've looked at some biological things that were very, very small, and I've seen the process of using the electron microscope, but the electron microscope didn't ever see anything smaller than what an optical microscope could go down and see. The main reason for using the electron microscope is because it uses X-ray, and the light and the heat of light would damage the item. So in other words, when you started looking at things down to, like, say, cellular structure, in other words, you got down to, like, one cell. Now, one cell is a lot of atoms in there. So, but I'm just saying that the smallest thing I've ever heard of anybody looking at inside that is, like, one biological cell and maybe some, you know, parts of a cell type of a thing. So in other words, that's about the smallest objects optically that I think anybody's ever viewed inside an electron microscope or an optical microscope, for that matter, Dick. But that's just my input here. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let me respond to this.
To use a scanning electron microscope, to your knowledge, Glenn, doesn't the material have to first have a conductive coating plated onto the object of observation? I don't think you can just take a biological substance and view it directly under a scanning, under an electron microscope. That's my belief. What's your feeling on that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
That's definitely a technique, Dick. There are also dyes that are used. There's basically preparing the sample so that you can actually view it in terms of depth and width is a big part of things. So there are many, many. That's just one of the methods of doing it. And keep in mind, too, one of the things about an X-ray that makes it so fascinating is that it doesn't reflect like light. In other words, you have reflection and diffraction with light. With X-ray, what you're basically doing is you're passing the X-ray through the sample, and what you're doing is on the other side, you're using a phosphor or a detector on the other side that's basically is looking at the negative. So in other words, what's happening is the X-ray that doesn't go through gets blocked. So sometimes coatings and other materials that are placed on the sample certainly enhance that image. But here again, we're talking about still items with many, many, many atoms. We're talking maybe a single cell structure and maybe a piece of a single cell structure. Very, very small items, but nowhere near atomic levels. And the other thing is, let me let it drop. When we go into the discussion of subatomics, most of that area is really an energy discussion, because when you have something at the atomic level, now you're a subatomic, that there's an issue with light. In other words, light will only reflect off of the surface, so it has to have mass. When you're in the subatomic spectrum, what can reflect? Because there's so much space in between the subatomic parts, say the electron, the speed of the electron, the nucleus, and because they're not a complete mass themselves, unless they're all together, what's visible? Here again, so there's kind of a controversy to what could be visible with light or X-ray would stop. In other words, would X-ray stop one electron or one particle? I don't believe so. I think also that when you look at things like accelerators, and when you accelerate a particle and you smash it, you smash an element, and then you're looking at particles, you're not really looking at the particle. You're looking at the effect of the energy of the particle. But that's just my input there. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have a comment on this. Thank you. And to Adrian, at first, electron scanning microscope, electron transmission microscope does not use X-ray. X-ray is a byproduct of it. That's why most of them, they have EDXRF. It uses the electron gun, and the electrons are the one that is being shooted. Now, as far as the resolution, now, under the best condition, human eye see 0.2 millimeters. The light scope see 0.2 micrometers. Scanning electron microscope, typically 3 nanometers. Transmission electron microscope, 0.2 nanometers. Now, the size of an atom is 0.3 nanometers in average. Now, we got your answers.
Have you heard numbers like that before, Glenn?
Yes, but here again, we're talking about resolution. And as I said, when you're talking about microscopes, optics, and resolution, but when we're talking about object size, that's like talking about pixels. You know, you take a photograph of something, and it's like, well, how detailed is your pixel? And when you get down to one pixel, how much information is in the pixel? Not a whole heck of a lot.
So are we discussing a pixel? So you kind of see where I'm going from. I'm using a digital analogy here. It's not exactly apropos, but it kind of gets the picture across. When you start talking about resolution, you're looking at how much detail, but it's not giving you a very good estimation of how small an object you can look at, because when you start getting into subatomics, you're really talking about energy now. You're not really talking about something that light reflects off of anymore. Back to you, Dick. K2RZ, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the light's not reflecting off of it in a useful manner, because the wavelength of light is extremely large, 1,500 times bigger than the object you'd like to view. But when it comes to scanning tunneling microscope and an atomic force microscope, where you're taking a physical sharp point and scanning it across the surface, and either sensing the atomic force or the tunneling electrons. In either of those two cases, I think you stand a chance of resolving the locations of the bumps that represent the location of each of the atoms or molecules that are on that surface. I think you stand a chance when you do it by those mechanical means. As crazy as that sounds, does that sound even slightly reasonable to you, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Dick, this is like so out of my area of expertise. I mean, I don't even know why someone would even want to see something like that, or if it's even possible. Here again, with the techniques that you're talking about, I know what they're used for, but I've never heard of them used in that way. As I said, the idea here is that you're trying to, the idea behind microscopes, electron microscopes, is to image. In other words, you're looking for a detail of an object that's very, very small. And in most cases, it's biological, because you're looking for something either in a cell or in an object. But why would you want to visually see a molecule? And there's velocities and energies involved. And I'm not sure that, here again, it's the same problem with light. In other words, okay, you're going to impose energy, and you're going to look for a ripple or bump, but I'm not sure really where that's going. I'm sorry, Dick, maybe I should step out of this conversation. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So let's separate this for a minute, though. You can be looking at biologicals, and you can be looking at non-biological material. Biological is a whole series of problems all by themselves. How do you image the biological material without damaging the material you're looking at? And how do you properly prepare the sample and whatever? It's a whole series of problems there. But when it comes to inorganic material, if I'm trying to follow Moore's law today, where every 18 months I'm going to double the number of transistors I put on a surface, and I'm continuously doubling every 18 months. We're getting down to the atomic level. As such, the purity of the silicon you start off with before you do your vapor deposition and you start assembling your super dense microwave integrated circuit or your large scale integrated circuit, before you get down to that level, let me drop. You think you've got an extremely pure chunk of silicon to begin with. You think there are no slip planes. You think there are no foreign materials. And as such, I'd like to be able to get the equivalent of an image of that surface, of that silicon wafer, before I start laying material on it. Because I know I'm going to get a certain failure rate of my production of these super high density integrated circuits. But if I can start off with material that is pure enough, that has a small enough number of slip planes to its molecular structure, and if I can do it by mechanical scanning procedures, whether it be atomic force, whether it be tunneling electrons or whatever, if I can get a view of that surface and find out how pure it is, I now know that my procedure up to that point for assembling the raw material from which I'm about to construct by vapor deposition and other crazy techniques, electron deposition, I'm about to start making these super dense circuits to find out how good is my raw material. I'd like to be able to get an image, and I think by mechanical means I might be able to do that. Does that sound slightly reasonable, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Yes, let the commercial go through. I kind of see where you're going with it, but I think that there's other complications that make this thing not as much of a visual. In other words, okay, let's say if we had a substrate with, 400 nanometer, a 400 nanometer transistor on it, and maybe even smaller, say maybe, a quarter of that, 100 nanometer structure on there. Is it actually visual? Or, in other words, and then, of course, there's the issue. When you're doing something at 100 to 400 nanometers of a transistor, is that in the horizontal plane, the vertical plane? You kind of understand where I'm from with this one. And then if it's, I think we're getting down into energy equations instead of things that are really optical or visual. So I think there's just a lot of very, very serious problems visualizing I don't think it's as simple as focus and being able to look at something like that. Here again, just an opinion, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
There's more to it, though, Glenn. Let me give you some more words. Let's assume that Glenn and Dick are running a beautiful, high production, high technology foundry in which we're building very exotic, very small integrated circuits. And let's assume now that the latest production run, you and I had a yield of 0.1%. We'd like the yield to be 98%, and we got 0.1% yield. And you and I say, wow, hey Glenn, you're my partner. Boy, we got troubles. We got to divide and conquer. Where did the problem occur? Were there flaws and contaminants in the raw material? Or did the individual vapor deposition and electron deposition, is it the procedure by which we took the raw material and went the next couple of steps? Is that where the error occurred that gave us the low yield? Okay? Because I want to divide and conquer, the first thing I want to do is the raw wafer before I laid anything down on it. Was it smooth enough, clean enough, low enough in contaminants, and low enough in slip planes? I want an image of that wafer before I started using it. And by mechanical means, I can get that picture. To give you another example, about 10 years ago, by doing this electron deposition and scanning electron microscope, the IBM company started off with a smooth surface, laid down individual atoms of silicon, and made the word IBM at the atomic level. Do you remember seeing that image? They did it. And if you can do that, now I stand the capability of constructing transistors at the atomic level. That's as small as you're going to get. And if I want to lay down a billion transistors on that wafer, I now stand the capability of doing it.
Repeater, timeout.
KC2QIQ, K2RW, do you remember seeing that picture of individual atoms laid on a smooth surface and they traced out the letters IBM? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick, but how big an image do you think that is? In other words, give me a number. How large do you think that was?
I am guessing those individual atoms on that surface that laid out the word IBM, the letters IBM, I know that they were sub-nanometer. They were some number of angstroms with those individual molecules they laid down, in my belief. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Dick, I would probably say that image that you saw there was thousands of nanometers. K2RIW, KC3QIQ. Maybe pass it over to somebody else.
Okay, you and I...
Mission for the adult space.
You and I will do some research and find out how big were the individual atoms and or molecules that made that symbol IBM a few years ago. Do you remember how big those individual atoms that trace out IBM, Werra, West, N2XJN, K2LIW?
No, I do not know, but I have a simple explanation for all of your doubts in terms of resolution. The resolution in light or electron transmission microscope could be seen as the resolution that is determined by formula by Ernst RBABBE, which actually is 0.61, that would be the wavelength in nanometers, sine as alpha. So if we take the wavelength peak to peak through the distances, radius, typical radius, miles to nanometers, that's the range. Infrared will be millimeters to 800 nanometers. Light would be 400 to 800 nanometers. Electrons will be more than 20 kilovolts per 0.8000 of nanometers. The higher the voltage that would lens at, the better way of seeing an image using an electron. Now, we know about the duality of an electron that could behave as a photon or it could behave as a particle. We now operating at 80,000 volts at approximate resolution of 0.4000 of the nanometers. That's why we are able to see something that is huge, which would be the structure of an atom, 0.3 of nanometers. So 8,000 of the nanometer is the typical size of an electron. The resolution, physical resolution they are able to reach is 0.4000 of nanometer, and 0.3000 of nanometer is an electron, is the atom structure. So there you go.
Wes, you have purchased and are assembling scanning electron microscope. I'm curious as to how many of the components are already in your possession. At the rate you're going, will it take you a week, a month, or 6 months, these are all acceptable numbers, for you to make that operational? I know that you intend to have in your house, in your laboratory, a scanning electron microscope. Roughly where are you on that road? You're one of the very rare guys I know that owns one of these. I don't know of any other ham in the United States that's got one. Over to you, Wes, KQLIW.
That was a beautiful gift from the scientists from Long Island. It was a gift. I have everything through the microscope. Actually, by accident, I've lost the tungsten V-shaped wire from the electron gun, but that could be purchased, and that will cost me more than a whole microscope ditch. But I have the EDXRF, Energy Dispersive X-ray Spectroscopy, that came with it, and mostly the problems that I have with it is one of the tubes is slightly bended, and it does have a little notch on the vacuum side. That could be eliminated. The other part is, for the EDXRF, I had a tank for the liquid nitrogen, and it did have a pre-vacuum for it. And actually, we couldn't feed it to the truck, that's why we took it out. That has to be repressured. Today I was lucky, because I got two vacuum pumps. John, the guy was right, I've checked that. Not necessarily. The guy said that the Edward vacuum pump, the bigger one that I've got, was the one to 10 times to minus 4, actually 2 to 10 times to minus 4. That's what I'm getting from this roughing pump. And the price for two pumps altogether was $200. So I've got a good buy on it. I think it's going to take me about 6 months, maybe earlier. There's approximately 2,000 pounds of everything, mostly copper, in the microscope. Thank you.
Wow. What do you believe, Wes, is going to be your first sample, your first target that you view with your electron microscope? That's question number one. And one other piece of information, the hairs that are growing out of my arm are what I think are about average. In other words, I've seen hairs growing in somebody's beard that are a lot heavier. I've seen hairs that are very fine growing out of a female's head that are finer. And I think the hairs growing out of my arm are sort of average. I just measured a few of them with my micrometer, with my calipers. And it looks like each one of the hairs growing out of my hand, at the back of my hand, along my arm, are approximately 0.5 times a thousandth of an inch, half of a thousandth of an inch of the diameters of the hair out of my arm. John's going to have to measure his hairs. Glenn's going to have to measure his. But so what do you believe is going to be the first thing you're going to view with your scanning electron microscope? And maybe you don't know yet. N2XJN, K2LAW.
It's a Coleman tube. I'm working on a project. I know what I get. And I know what I'm going to. I need to finish up the project and give it away. I see the reaction, and for me, it's no doubt about it. I just want to see the Coleman compound before applying 300 to 500 megahertz radio frequency to it, which, based on the official science, should not, and based on your words, they should not react with the matter by changing the properties of the matter. So that was proven. It's a big step that would actually put in question, with all due respect that I have for you, and I thank you for everything that you're doing for us. Actually, we were talking with John about how unique is what you're doing, but that would be put in question a lot. And to explain.
Yeah, it's my belief, and I may be dead wrong, but it's my belief that for in a home laboratory to create an atomic reaction, is my belief it's very, very difficult. Natural, spontaneous radioactivity, where a radioactive substance emits, yes, I'll give you that. But for you to take a substance, bombard that substance by some means, and actually create a nuclear reaction by which whatever particles you're using penetrate the outer cloud of electrons of the atom, penetrate that cloud, get down to the nucleus, and change something on the nucleus. Add a proton, add a neutron, select, bounce out a proton, bounce out a neutron, to make a nuclear reaction in a home laboratory. It's my belief that that nucleus is so extremely tiny. It's 1/100,000th of the diameter of the outer shell of electrons. Let me drop. So it is an extremely small target at the atomic level. It's a very small target, very hard to hit with the most accurate gun you and I can envision. On top of that, it has a ridiculous amount of protection, that outer shell of electrons. For all practical purposes, it's an iron shell that's very hard to penetrate. So to create a nuclear reaction without using something like a Large Hadron Collider, my belief is that's very difficult. I know that some of the patents you've experienced, that you've discovered, and some of the reactions that are claimed by some of the people that you're aware of, claim that by bombarding material with 300 megacycle RF energy, that a nuclear reaction is being created. And so I think we've got to go very slow and very careful on that, because to get to that nucleus, that's what a nuclear reaction is. You're getting to that nucleus and changing it. And wow, I think that is hard. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Oh, very good. If it wasn't possible that there is no issue, it's just my imagination. Beautiful. Well, at first, it's not hard to get it. You have nuclear reaction in fluids, and you don't need any special devices for it, but we're not going to discuss it. We have 2 minutes left. What I want to stress in here is when you put a very, very high voltage, you're actually creating an X-ray out of the nuclear structure, because repositioning of the electrons gives you always, and no exclusion, the X-ray. Only if there is a last N shell and the electrons are very loosely bonded, that one does not create an X-ray. So there would be an explanation for the electrical currents flowing over the wires. But the spectral dependency is like that. The microwave creates the rotation. The infrared creates the vibration. The visible light partially, along with the ultraviolet, just approaching with ultraviolet, creates a fusion, which will be the electronic excitation, the temporary fusion of two atoms. Then X-ray creates bond breaking and ionization, and then we have a gamma rays, which they say doesn't do anything. Can you believe that? That's the visual science. So far I didn't prove that radio wave at 200 megahertz could affect the matter. Thanks God. Because this explanation is right at that moment. What if it's proven otherwise? And to exist.
If it's proven otherwise, it's significant, but we got to be very close and very careful on what we describe as proof. When I'm exposing a material with 300 megahertz RF energy, and I'm looking for a nuclear reaction, and I'm trying to detect the nuclear reaction with something like a Geiger counter. A Geiger counter is very sensitive to RF energy. The amplifying circuits on the Geiger-Mullen tube of a Geiger counter can easily be fooled by the RF energy, and you'll get the needle on the Geiger counter will move, not because a nuclear reaction took place necessarily. It could be because RF energy is being detected by that amplifier, being amplified, and it's moving the needle, and it looks like a nuclear reaction, but I'm worried it might not be. That's what I'm concerned about, Wes. KQRIW?
Well, if it's proven that this is my imagination, it's okay. The world will be the way that it was.
Okay. I'm going to follow you guys. That was TechNet number 1473. And as long as we all stay healthy, we think we'll be next week back and digging a little bit deeper into some of these subjects. We'll almost discover how some of this stuff works. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. John, KC2WGB, KQLIW, you got it, John.
thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.